Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started with this session. Welcome to Concurrent Session 1C. The title of this presentation is Longevity Derivatives, Illustrating a New Approach to Investing. The speaker is Zach Roberts. My name is Clive Aaron. I'm going to be chairing this session. The way we're going to structure it is Zach will take us through his presentation, and that's going to take about half an hour, and then we'll have around about 15 minutes for questions. There is one microphone. It's taped to a stand that is fixed to the floor, so it's not a roving mic. If you have a question, please can you make your way to the microphone, which is in the middle of the room, and if you could please give your name before you make your comments or ask your question, because the session is being recorded. So just a bit of background about Zach. Zach studied at university in Japan, and when he graduated, he joined Towers Perrin, and he was with Towers Perrin for about 8 years, mostly in Japan, but during that period he spent a fair bit of time working throughout the Asia region. 2 years ago, Zach joined Deutsche Bank, and he works in their superannuation and insurance group within global markets, where he works with superannuation funds and insurers to implement solutions that address their key issues of risk management, return enhancement, and capital efficiency. And Zach is also a member of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. If you could please welcome Zach.
Thank you, Clive, and good morning, everyone. When I decided to speak about longevity derivatives, I thought I'd start by putting it in context and by that talk about, say, what is this new investment approach that I'm hearing a lot more about at different seminars, and including, you know, this morning, both speakers this morning. So probably for about 10 to 15 minutes we're going to talk about that, probably a little bit more depth than this morning's presentation went into, so I'm very thankful for them doing what they did this morning, actually. And then we're going to use longevity as an example of how to apply that thought process. Okay, so put it in context of here is potentially what we should be doing with investments. And then, you know, while that, you know, theory might all sound fine and good, but how do you do it? Then we'll look at longevity and say, well, here's an example of how to do it. And just to show that this isn't all just sort of here's what I think, I'm going to borrow on information from a lot of other sources. You could say it was maybe just because I was lazy, but anyway. I was at a asset allocation summit in February in Sydney this year, Terrapin Asset Allocation Summit, and there was a gentleman there, Eric Valtonen, who's a chief investment officer for one of the Swedish sovereign funds. And he gave a great few slides, I think, on illustrating what's gone wrong with the typical investment approach. He started off by saying, let's look at alternative assets. Why do we want alternative assets? Obviously, they've got to have reasonable return expectations, but one of the big drivers was because they're not correlated to other assets. And he said, that's fine and good. He gave an example here of alternative X against equities, and said, if you just look at one standard deviation either side in equity returns, then that looks great. And you might think, wow, X is a great diversifier for my portfolio. I'll have some of that, please. Let's go to two standard deviations. Not so great, but still good. You'd still say, well, that's pretty diversified. Oh, my. Once you actually look at all the scenarios and everything that's possible, you start to realise that it's all gone a bit pear-shaped. And as Eric rightly pointed out, no one likes the pointy end of a pear. So what is it that went wrong with alternative assets? One of the things that I've heard a lot at other conferences is this recurring theme of institutional investors not being happy with the return of their alternatives. You know, they had these alternative assets which, as Bob said this morning, were expected to just gradually perform, and they didn't. Things like private equity, infrastructure, and a lot of hedge funds. So why haven't they performed as expected? I think the problem is that they actually have performed exactly as expected. It's just that people didn't understand what they were buying. Okay, a lot of these things, private equity, infrastructure, hedge funds, where do the returns come from? What are the risks that are being taken? And if you delve below the surface, you'll see a lot of it is the equity risk premium, you know, debt risk premium, except that it had often had liquidity and leverage and funding risk premium thrown in. And you've almost got, you know, these evil investment bankers acting as the chefs, saying, well, let's take a bit of this, a bit of this, a bit of this, mix it together, call it something new, and we can flog that. Okay. So I put it to you that maybe these alternative assets, if you actually understood what they were, have actually performed pretty much as expected. And I think that's what's sort of driving what I see is the impetus for a different way of investing. And it's, I'm going to borrow here from someone from Tyndall, Simon O'Grady, had a paper out about 2 months ago. And understanding risk premium is the key. He's got, what is risk premium? You know, we talk about the equity risk premium, the credit risk premium. What is a risk premium? It's the payment you get over and above the risk-free rate for putting your capital at risk. Okay, Bob talked about it earlier. We've tended to focus on, oh, we get this small risk premium, small return, without understanding, yes, that's because we are taking a risk. When something happens, we will lose our capital. And maybe that's understanding that is where we should focus on, not just trying to turn that 100 basis point risk premium into 150. You know, understand what risk you're actually taking here. And I like risk premium because there's a lot more of them than there are of asset classes, as we just saw. You know, what we commonly called asset classes were just combinations of other risk premium. So if you can look at the risk premium level, you can actually get, you know, a better understanding of what it is, and you might actually find out that through different asset classes, you're actually taking on a lot more of a particular risk premium than you want. So what are the benefits of thinking this way? I think, you know, these are all from, you know, Simon's article, but I like them because it saved me the time of writing them, and I thought basically the same thing, that it makes you highly aware of the risks you're taking. It makes you ask the question, where are these risks coming from? And, you know, in other words, where are my returns coming from? It makes you think of, you know, investing more as an insurance type thing, that you are receiving, you know, it is called a risk premium for something. You are receiving this small, steady income stream for taking on the risk that you will lose a lot of money. And I think it also provides a framework so that you can look at all sort of the investment universe in the same manner, instead of saying, well, these are my traditional things, these are my alternative things, and they're in different buckets and they stay in different buckets. Okay, this is no. They're all just ways of making money or of putting your capital at risk with the expectation of making money. So personally, my own opinion here is that I think that the main role for a fund manager is to understand what are all the risk premium out there. You know, what drives the returns? How are they likely to behave in different circumstances? And then construct my portfolio so that I have access to the risk premium that I want. You know, and alter that frequently. Okay, and we'll get into, you know, if that's how I think we should be doing things, where actually are we, and how can we get there? Now, there's a few objections I'd like to, I suppose, try to remove first before we go on. As I've just said, we should be changing our allocations to different risk premium frequently. Now, that's all against the let's have a strategic asset allocation and stick to it. So objection number one, you know, surely you should have a strategic asset allocation, stick to it over the long term, that's the best investment approach. Who's heard that one before? No? Okay. Who here has thought that what that actually means is that means whether interest rates are 2% or 12%, I should have the same exposure to interest rates? Yeah. Or equity markets. Whether equities are at a P/E ratio of 10 or 25, I should own the same amount of them. No. I mean, if we say that there is a long-term equity risk premium and that equity markets mean revert, surely when they're at 25, the medium-term return expectation must be lower than when they're at 10. It's mathematics. You know, that bit's mathematics. Mm-hmm. But it's not just about understanding the different risk premiums. Even if you like one, it's about getting that in the best way. Like, you know, this morning speakers alluded to the fact that credit has just become more like the equity risk premium. And, you know, a good example of that is just last week, Rio Tinto issued some bonds at about 7% above swap rates. Now, most consultants or people in the investment world will tell you the equity risk premium is about 3 to 5%. Here's 7%, which is you're guaranteed to get as long as Rio Tinto doesn't go bankrupt. Okay? So even if you are an investor saying, well, I want this allocation to equities, no, what you want is an allocation to the equity risk premium, and what's the best way to get that right now? Maybe it's not through owning equities. Okay, for those who are coming on the journey with me, the next objection. Okay, maybe you're right, but surely it's too difficult to consistently add value over the long term through moving from one asset class to another. Like, that's market timing, that's just too difficult. Now, I'm not saying whether it's possible or not. I just like to point out that most people who make that objection then advocate active asset management within an asset class. As, you know, well, okay, you set your asset allocations, then within your asset class, maximise your returns. This manager's better than this one. So let's just have a look at what we're actually doing here. Active equity management, adjusting your allocation between different equities based on an assessment of the relative value of the equities available. Now, you might be a value bias or a small cap bias, but that's basically what you're doing. So what's active risk premium management? Well, do you know it's the same thing? Except it's doing it in an area where there's actually a lot more scope to add value. Because there is a lot more potential for differences in performance of different risk premia than there is of sort of different equities within one asset class. Now, I don't want to get in the whole active-passive debate, because I don't think, you know, whether you believe in active equity management or not, I don't think it's the point. If you do believe in it, it's still not where you should be spending most of your time, because there's still more value to be made in active risk premium management. Okay. But I would just point out that there are two studies that I recently became aware of, one by Farmer and French, published March this year, that looked at mutual fund returns in the US from 1962 to 1996, and from their abstract, I quote, "No evidence that any managers have enough skill to cover the costs they impose on investors." Another one here by academics from three different universities who looked at over 2,000 actively managed US equity funds between 1975 and 2006. And they compared the performance of the funds post fees compared to a relevant benchmark. And they find that 24% of funds underperformed their benchmark. They might say, great, 76% did well. Unfortunately, they found that 75.4% added just enough value to get themselves back to their benchmark. And 0.6% outperformed their benchmark. Okay. Now, whether or not you agree with those numbers or not, let's just assume for the purposes of the next half hour that you agree that there is more potential to add value in actively managed risk premium as opposed to actively managing individual investments within a risk premium. So this is, I put new because it's just common sense, really. You know, let's understand what our liabilities are, what our objectives are, what our, you know, risk appetite is. Let's then understand the universe of risk premia that are available. Yeah. Let's determine our desired mix of these risk premia. then for each risk premium, let's work out the best way of gaining access to that risk premium. Whether it be active management, passive management, it might be different for each one. Okay. Then let's look at, within the risk premium, is there a way that I can protect myself against, well, what if I'm wrong? Yeah. And do this frequently. Don't do this every 2 or 3 years. Do this frequently. You know, again, from this morning, there was an example of the spreads on the CDS rates on the Australian government. I'm hearing again and again from investors saying, well, I don't want to take risk at the moment, so therefore, you know, I'm in cash and government bonds, but I've got to take advantage of these government-guaranteed bank bonds. You know, they pay swaps plus 70 basis points for government risk. We just saw this morning you could hold cash and sell a government CDS and earn swaps plus 170. It's the same risk. And it's actually more liquid because you're holding cash. So it's, as well as identifying the risk premium, it's important to know what's the best way to get access to them. I'll skip that bit. So what are the benefits of this new approach? I think the biggest one is that you'll have asset class allocation decisions made by the people most capable of making them. You know, at the moment, we have the whole investment management industry running around focusing on maximising returns within an asset class. And who is left to make the asset class allocation decisions? It's your average person in consultation with their financial planner. Okay. Now, I've got nothing against financial planners, but surely those investment professionals are better able to make that most important investment decision. And then a bit of sensationalism here, because we've got to give people something to talk about. The other benefit is there is a big opportunity here that maybe we can actually avoid the $1 trillion superannuation mis-selling scandal. Okay, now what do I mean by that? I mean, you have almost every balanced super fund out there in Australia saying that we target inflation plus X percent over a Y-year period. Okay, now let's, for argument's sake, let's say it's inflation plus 4% over a 5-year period. Okay? Okay. You've just earned inflation minus 20% in 1 year. What are you going to do differently for the next 4 years so that over the 5 years that started a year ago, you earn inflation plus 4%? Now, that's a rhetorical question because there's not much you can do. Okay? So what are you going to do differently to make sure you don't land yourself in this mess again? That one's not rhetorical. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do differently? And if the answer to that's nothing, I don't see how you can look yourself in the mirror and say, we target inflation plus X percent. Yeah. What you do is you hold a balanced portfolio, try to do the same as everyone else, and hope that that delivers you inflation plus 4%. Yeah. If you want to target inflation plus 4%, for example, using the Rio Tinto example I just had, that bond will give you swaps plus 7%. An inflation swap will probably cost at the moment about swaps minus 1%. So there is an investment which will pay inflation plus 8% if you just have a Rio Tinto bond and an inflation swap. And the only way it won't do that is if Rio Tinto defaults. Okay. Now, more to prove this is just not me talking, this is actually happening. Okay. 2 weeks ago now, I was talking to the research part of a large super fund who has a return objective, what do you know? CPI plus X percent over Y year rolling periods. And I asked about, well, their risk tolerances. They have no specific risk tolerances. So I put it to them, well, what's, and they wanted to talk about inflation protection. So I said, well, what's your preferred investment approach to start with, you know? Are you trying to achieve returns consistent with your peers, consistent with a balanced fund, and hope that that gets you to your target? Or are you actually trying to get to your target, you know, your publicised target in the lowest risk way possible? Okay? And I had to include a quote from his email because, again, I couldn't have written it better myself, in that a sensible investor would be looking to achieve CPI plus X percent at the lowest risk. An investor that's roughly consistent with its peers while trying to do this is the approach taken by most super funds, including ours. One approach is where we should be heading, the other is where we are. Okay, so hopefully that hasn't disappointed all the people who actually came here to hear about longevity. We'll start that bit now. But it's important because longevity is such a unusual concept, especially when you look at longevity as an asset, that I thought we'd put it in context, and we'll talk now about longevity and show how you can use that approach we've just discussed to analyse an unusual investment. Longevity is actually part of the wider group of insurance-linked securities. These are actually getting a lot more interest at the moment from investors for two reasons, really. One is that over the last year, they have stayed not as correlated as others. Just to give Clive a plug, there's a good article in the Towers Perrin Emphasis magazine that talks about insurance-linked securities. And it's not, I'm sure no one can see this, but it's got a graph of, here's the performance of a double B investment grade bond portfolio, an index, since April 07, and basically it's down 30%. It's then got the performance of average of double B rated catastrophe bonds, they're down 5%. Okay, so it's one of those few alternatives that has actually proven its worth over the last year and a half. But we're not here to talk about catastrophe bonds, we're here to talk about longevity. One of the reasons that insurance-linked securities or longevity investments in particular have stayed uncorrelated is that their returns are driven by different things. They're not those other things just put together and mixed up and called something else. Now, for different types of investments, it's different things that drives them, but they tend to have as a recurring theme that it's some type of, I don't want to say arbitrage because that implies risk-free, but it's some type of imbalance between someone's needs and someone else's possibilities, or some type of information misbalance. Catastrophic mortality, it could be as simple as a reinsurer is happy to pay away more than the expected loss on a bond because that gives them capital savings. So as an investor, you can invest at more than the expected loss. And that's what gives rise to a risk premium. If you could only invest at the expected loss, that's a risk premium of zero. So it's all about investing at more than the expected risk premium. Sorry, those three were just different ways of accessing what I would call, say, the longevity risk premium. I'm going to focus for a couple of slides now on the one on the right because it's the one with the highest expected return. So if you're going to start somewhere, you might as well start there. In the US, in particular, there's a lot of elderly individuals with very large life insurance policies, often driven by tax planning reasons. And a fair proportion of those people are now realising, well, my children are all driving BMWs. They don't need money when I pass away. And my equities have just been hammered. My other assets have been hammered. Maybe there's something better I could be doing with this money that I'm putting into this insurance policy. So they go back to the insurance company, I want to surrender this policy. Well, surprise to them, probably not surprise to anyone else in this room, the surrender value is not too high. Okay. So what you can actually do in the US instead is sell the policy to someone else. Okay. What happens there, the investor buys the policy, and the investor must make future premium payments. The investor receives a death benefit when the person insured passes away. It's that simple. So what's going to determine the IRR of this type of investment? Three things, basically. How much you pay for the policy up front when you buy it from someone. What are the size of the ongoing premium payments and how long will you end up making them for? And then what's the timing and size of the death benefit? None of those related to the equity risk premium or the credit risk premium or any of those other risk premiums. Now, the way this market trades is that people basically have a target IRR, and that's how they back solve to work out, here's how much I'm going to pay up front for a policy. They say, well, here's my life expectancy estimation of certain individuals, and you do get an updated life expectancy report when someone's selling a policy, so you don't have to rely on you know, the underwriting done by the insurance company when they sold the policy in the first place. It's up-to-date medical information. Use the life expectancy and then make sure that they'll pay X because that gives them an IRR of Y. Okay. Now, the IRRs they're targeting at the moment are about 14 to 18% in US dollars. So you're looking at, as if this person dies as per expectations, I'm going to make a return of about risk-free plus 10%. Here's just the joke for non-actuaries, isn't it? As well as being uncorrelated, this is actually low volatility because that yellow line there is the rate of change in mortality rates. Okay? They don't go up and down. Yes, you're going to have some market value movements along the way, as you know, flight to quality is going to see less assets going in here, maybe some forced sellers of this. But if you hold this to maturity, you will get the death benefit. It's just a matter of when. Now, where the derivatives part come in, this was called longevity derivatives. One of the problems with buying, you know, life policies is that, as we all know, when one person dies isn't very certain at all. It's only once you have enough of them that it becomes more certain. So there is the concept of a longevity swap, longevity index swap, which is basically economically similar, or the same as, if you are able to buy the life insurance policies of a large number of individuals, let's say 500 individuals, that were all the same size death benefits as well. How much would you pay for them now? That's the upfront cost. And then ongoing every quarter, for anyone who passes away during that quarter, you get that death benefit, which would be, you know, 1/500th of the total death benefit. For anyone still alive, you pay the insurance premiums. So it goes a long way to removing, I suppose, what you might call the idiosyncratic risk that comes from just buying individual policies. Because it takes a lot of money to buy 500 policies. A lot of these have like million, $2 million death benefits. So it's sort of a way of giving you access to, you know, the longevity beta as such, like the longevity risk premium, without a lot of the complicating factors. So it's that sort of swap idea is a way of trying to keep the green bits, which is what is attractive about, say, longevity as an asset class. The fact that it's not correlated, the return expectations are high, and it's got low volatility. But do away with the red bits. You know? There's a lot of other red bits there, which we don't have time to go into, but there's a lot of them. Now, I think one of the biggest disadvantages of a longevity index swap is that it's complex at a time when people hate complexity. And it is even less liquid than the policies if you just bought policies themselves. So there are, you know, alternatives to trying to get the same benefits as a longevity index swap without those extra two disadvantages. One is a longevity index fund. A longevity fund, basically. There are retail funds out there who invest in, buy policies, basically. And through an investment in one of these funds, you can get exposure to a large number of policies. You know, people may like them because they're what you're used to. You just buy units. And you can get exposure to a large number of policies without a large investment. There are several disadvantages. High fees, you know, being an unusual fund, they'll often charge, you know, 2 and 20% when there's not really much they can do after they've bought the policies to determine the outcome. You know, it's very questionable whether this is an asset class that you want to pay someone to manage on an ongoing basis for you. There's fund manager risks, and I think the biggest one is that this is an illiquid asset. Don't buy it in a liquid fund. I think we're learning that lesson slowly. Don't buy liquid things in liquid funds, otherwise you get forced selling and all sorts of problems. And as an example, there's a longevity fund based in Queensland, which for about 3 months last year was closed to redemptions. Instead, for the same advantages, if you have enough money, so if you are an institutional investor, you could basically create your own longevity fund. You know, where, you know, in a fund, You could direct the purchase of policies that sit in a fund. You own the units in that fund, and you and only you own those units. Okay. Now, probably if you've got around 50 to 100 million to invest, that's big enough to do that. Okay. That's big enough to diversify a lot of the idiosyncratic risk away, without introducing all those risks that come with being, part in a fund, which is a liquid fund but holds illiquid assets. And all you really need to do then is make sure that the policies purchased by this fund are purchased at a reasonable price following, a pre-approved manner. And that's where, you could either do that yourself if you had the time and inclination, or there's a number of actuarial consultancies who do help investors do this. This is a bit of an old graph again. Maybe I was too lazy to update it. But I've got 12% expected returns there. It is more like about 14 to 16 at the moment. But I left this in here just really to illustrate that, that's 14% is what you expect to get around the midpoint. This is not a, someone lives longer, I will earn less. That's correct. But it's not someone lives longer, I will earn less than risk-free. If someone lives longer, I will earn less than risk-free plus 10%. And they've got to live significantly longer till the rate you earn starts approaching risk-free and going through risk-free. And eventually, it will become negative if they live long enough, which is why you wouldn't want to buy one policy. This is sort of my last slide on this part, which is just sort of back to basics, that why is it that we might be interested in, say, longevity as an asset class? It's not correlated. And as I pointed out, the reason it's not correlated isn't just because it's illiquid and only valued once a year. Okay, that's, I don't think we'll fall for that trick again. It's not correlated because it's driven by different things. It does have high return potential and it does have low volatility. Now, I do actually have a couple of slides here which talk about if you actually, at an institution which has longevity as a risk on the liability side, how these type of approaches can be applied to managing your liability risk. One about just using a swap to remove your longevity risk. Another one about using two swaps to transform your longevity risk so that you can either be left with the same amount of longevity risk but have a higher expected return on that, or you could engineer it so that you have the same expected return but a lower absolute level of risk and thus a lower capital requirement. So I'm happy to go into those, but just conscious of time, I'd like to check if we've got any questions first.
Paul Murphy, where would you find in Australia the non-participating level premium products to invest in if you're setting up a fund of this kind?
The reason that these funds are based on US lives is that they are based on whole of life level premium term US insurance policies, which don't exist in Australia. So you're right, if you're setting up a fund of this type, you don't want to do it by buying Australian life insurance policies. You want to go somewhere where the return, and I didn't point it out before, but thanks for raising it, it's quite important that the death benefit here is non-participating. It's not related to the performance of investment markets at all. So you're not just taking on investment risk through the back door. Come on, there must be more. Yeah.
Phil, you've got to go to the microphone.
Comments? I'm even happy for criticisms. I'm sure none of you are thinking of any of those.
Phil, so just a simple question, Zach. Yes. Why is the risk premium so high?
Basically because it's a few reasons. One, it's complicated. So, your average person hasn't just jumped into it. It is illiquid. But mainly, it comes down to, I think it's there, again, a quote from someone else, that these average policies, if someone wants to surrender this back to the life insurance company, you receive about 4% of the death benefit as a surrender value. as an investor, I can pay 30% and buy it. So you as a person policyholder, you're over the moon. You've got three or four times what you would have got. But if you actually do your fair value analysis and say, well, okay, if I want to discount this at the risk-free rate based on best estimate mortality expectations, you'll find it's actually worth about 60%. Okay? It's like someone put this to me recently. Someone said, oh, I get it. It's a distressed asset that's always distressed. It's not just distressed now because of the environment market. It's always selling at distressed prices.
Isn't that unethical?
Which part of it? Because there's a few answers to that question.
Well, because the individual selling the policy could get more value.
How?
Yeah, how? But it comes back to the original policy being sold at too low, or the insurance coming back at too low a price.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that the practices of selling insurance policies with, you know, prices subsidised by low surrender values is unethical. The sort of most commonly quoted answer to is this unethical is by buying this policy from someone, you're helping them get out of it at a better price than they could otherwise do. You know? I don't see much that's unethical about that. Whoever sold them the policy that put them in this position in the first place, that's a different question.
The risk of the insurer deciding to change their surrender value basis. If it's demonstrably unfair, the surrender values that are being offered, what's to stop legislators and whatever else at some stage in future, or just client pressures, actually demanding much more reasonable values? If the secondary market's paying 30%, then clearly 4% is just ridiculously low. And it seems to be at a huge legislative or product-based risk there.
No, that's a good point, and this has been looked into quite a bit. There are examples of one or two insurers in the US who stopped selling policies to elderly individuals because they were afraid that they were just going to unsell them. They lasted about 2 months until their rankings went too far on the premium league tables, and they started selling them again. I think it's partly comes down to the fact that... I've lost my train of thought. I'll come back. Sorry, Jeff.
Jeff Austin. Zach, wouldn't you expect, if this was a market that developed, that there'd be price bidding so that the 30% would become 40, 50, 60%, so that over a period of time, the excess risk premium, if you like, would go out of the marketplace?
Yes, there has been a bit of that. Say, 5 years ago, you know, to choose these trade at all different prices depending on the policy, but let's say the average price was 14%, say 5 years ago, it did gradually come into about 12. Then a few things happened. The financial crisis happened, and also there was a change to the US Society of Actuaries mortality tables, and a lot of the medical underwriters changed their life expectancy, and people who were buying these didn't necessarily know that there was a risk of that happening. So they've just gone, wow, this isn't a free 10%, there is risk here. So what you've actually found happen is that you've had a big move the other way, and where people were demanding 12% return, they're now demanding 16 on a much harsher mortality basis as well, which might have been sort of 18 or 20 on the old one. So there is the risk, there's no evidence of it yet though. But if you're already invested, fantastic if that happens. Just driving the value of your asset up.
Zach, Nick Khalil, a comment really on the part that you haven't really covered yet, which is on longevity swaps, but it's something that I think is relevant to some funds in Australia, to pension funds, but superannuation funds, that is. But clearly is a big issue overseas in the UK, and this sort of swapping is going on, you know, in various different forms, in great quantities over there. But my question perhaps to both of you would be, with this swap concept, the trouble I have is understanding who is the natural counterparty to the swap. In other words, if you've got a pension fund, and as I would understand it, an insurer would have the same risk, they are exposed to increasing longevity, someone's got to take the other side of that for there to be a decent market in this. And I suppose, you know, there are two possibilities there. One camp is just the financial engineers who are looking to take the opposite side of everything, but if we can assume for the sake of the argument that they've been cleaned out of the marketplace at the moment. The other argument I've heard is that, you know, you can look at, say, a pharmaceutical company who focuses on selling, you know, drugs to the elderly, and so if longevity decreases, they lose a part of their marketplace. It's a pretty tenuous argument for mine. So where, if this is to take off, where do we find that other side of the market?
I think you've raised a good point. It's for institutions who already have longevity risk, right now probably the best price that you can get for a longevity swap to remove your particular risk is from a reinsurer. Okay, and the reason a reinsurer will probably give you a better price than a bank is that for a reinsurer, they've normally got a long mortality position, that they've got more mortality risk, so this is actually a sort of a hedge for them. So it can actually decrease their capital requirements. Now, you as an institution, though, are still probably not going to be overly impressed with the price that you get shown on a longevity swap. That's where I think, that's why I've got this page up here. If you're dead against longevity risk, then take the swap. That's great. But if you say, look, I don't like longevity risk at the moment because it's giving me too low a return on capital. You know, I've got, or too low a return if you're a defined benefit pension plan and you're not holding capital, too low a return on the risk. So what you can do then say is, okay, well, if I did swap it away, then I could swap back in some US longevity risk, which has a much, much greater expected return. And you could, if you wanted to, you could leave yourself with the same amount of longevity risk, or same amount, same capital requirement behind longevity, but the longevity risk you're holding isn't now paying you an expected return basically of the swap rate, it's paying you swap plus 10. Or if you didn't want to earn extra money and just wanted to earn, you know, the swap rate on a certain amount of money, you could probably halve or even more, like even further reduce the actual amount of longevity risk you have to hold to get that return. If you swapped out all of your, say, Australian longevity risk and then swap back in half or a third of that size of risk, but US longevity risk.
I think we're out of time. So,
I just wanted to say that Zach always gives a very thoughtful presentation. He's not scared to duck controversy, and that always makes for an entertaining presentation. So please, will you join me in thanking Zach?